One and live, Carissa, here we are. I'm talking from my lockdown, my third lockdown in UK. I don't know if you are in lockdown, you're not in lockdown. I don't know. Now is the, where are you?
I'm in Oxford, so yeah, same as you.
All right, so you're in my same situation, third lockdown. How are you coping with that? Because I start to be a little bit tired now. I don't know how many other lockdowns can I handle. I don't know.
Yeah, it's not easy. I mean, the good thing is that the vaccine is here. Otherwise, I would be climbing the walls. But I miss normal life. I miss going out, seeing people, eating out.
By the way, Carissa, there is also the Oxford vaccine, or I'm losing now the count with the Chinese Russian vaccine and the other one, the Italians. Now they are doing the vaccine. There is the Oxford vaccine. Am I right?
Yeah, the Oxford vaccine. I got approval a few weeks ago, and I think they're rolling it out now as well.
I read the other day that Boris Bojo want to offer the vaccine jab to all of the population by September, something like that. So that is a very optimistic plan, I think. But I mean, it will be a good result, probably.
Yeah, that's the plan, and they're vaccinating about almost 1 million people per week, if I remember correctly.
Right. We'll see. I don't know. This is also, by the way, another interesting topic with privacy and health data, medical records. You know, it will be interesting to see also that evolution. But let's start from another point that I was really curious about to kick off our conversation immediately. And is this WhatsApp terms of use change, and then the world go crazy and people say, oh, let's go everyone on Signal and Telegram. And obviously these people say, ah, fantastic, we are great, we protect your data, whatever it's, you know. And from time to time you see these reactions. I remember also with DuckDuckGo at the beginning when they launched, they said, we are the good guys, Google are the bad guys, move everything that you search to our search engine. But anyway, the main problem is that what are we going to do? I mean, WhatsApp is changing the terms of use. Then they say, no, they will delay, but they will not really, you know, use our data. I would like to start with a picture from you about the situation that you see today with these big tech players dealing with our data. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. So there are a few companies, I mean, there are hundreds of companies, but a few really big ones that basically their business model is exploiting personal data. There are different ways in which they do this, but a company like Facebook sells access to us. So essentially they sell access to certain characteristics of us and for advertisers to show us very targeted content and ads. So things like where you live, whether you're a man or a woman, what kind of job do you have, what kind of car do you have, all kinds of things that in fact end up being much more personal than they sound. Because like you might say, well, I don't care, you know, people knowing what kind of car I drive. But in fact, they can infer a lot from that kind of thing. So with WhatsApp at the moment, there has been a change in terms of service. And it's interesting because actually not a lot has changed. Basically, they wanted to make WhatsApp more agreeable so that people can communicate with businesses. And what happened is that people got really upset and moved places. And now why do they get upset? I mean, some of it is just not understanding that not a lot has changed. However, even though not a lot has changed, the terms and conditions were already quite bad. So, I mean, it's true that WhatsApp shares information with Facebook, even though when Facebook bought WhatsApp in 2014, they promised that they wouldn't. And 2 years later, they broke that promise. So that's one thing. I think people are just tired of having companies like Facebook bully us and change their minds over and over again and break promises and violate our privacy. But another thing that I think is a good reason why people change is that these changes remind us how authoritarian these terms and conditions are. They're just like, take it or leave it. And, you know, yeah, we give you time to read them, but there's no negotiating here. It's one thing or you can't use the platform. And of course, this is a platform that we've come to depend on, that we're really used to. And that's a really bad kind of treatment.
But Carissa, before to keep going, you had a lot of sun coming in from England, probably, you know, in Britain. Yeah. We have fantastic sun today. And you suddenly, the feeling is like Mark Zuckerberg, as soon as you said Facebook, said, all right, I will make you more or less invisible. So I can see you, but it's so much light. And you're
actually, this has never happened to me before. Yeah, I have a camera, but it's not being recognized.
Are you connected with the phone or is a webcam?
With the webcam.
All right. Okay. So it's like the exposure probably of the webcam went crazy. Try to move it around and while you experiment. Now it's really like I think Zach hacked your webcam probably. I'll let you try if you want to reconnect so that we can see that. You properly. Sorry, yeah. I'll be waiting for you here. No worries. Okay. Interesting. We'll see what will happen. Imagine that if you say something wrong, I will not close your internet connection. I will not quit your microphone. No. What I will do, I will increase your exposure and creating a ghost out of you. That would be a great, great reaction. By the way, guys, hello to everyone. I hope you are good wherever you are in the world. I'm still here in Brighton. Lockdown, third lockdown, day number something, I forgot. We keep going. I hope you well. I wish you well. And we'll see what will happen next. A couple of words with Carissa. Oh, Carissa's back. And now we're talking. Now we're talking, Carissa. That's different. Yeah, that's so much better. Sorry for that, but I just wanted to see your face and not a ghost created by Zuckerberg. And so my question, Carissa, is the following. When we talk about privacy, or as we say in Italy, privacy, the reaction is always the same. Everyone get very cross and everyone say, no, privacy is fundamental, blah, blah, blah. And I will do everything to protect my privacy. Good. The next step is as soon as I offer you something for free, a free email, a free profile, a free whatever is, you give up everything and you give all of your data without zero discussion, you know, in exchange of something free. So there is this bit of paradox that I see. I don't know if you see the same.
That's true. And it's actually called the privacy paradox.
Right.
There have been like many hypotheses about why this is so. I think it's a number of things. For one thing, privacy has become something very intangible in the digital age. So, you know, in 1950s or 60s or even 80s, if you went for a job interview and the interviewer asked you, hey, do you plan to have kids anytime soon? It was kind of really obvious how the answer to that question might jeopardize you getting hired. And people had to ask you for things very directly. Whereas today, you might be discriminated against because you're planning to have kids, but you'll never know about it because you gave like kind of this data point here, that data point there. It might have been a year ago, and then, you know, a year later you ask for a job and you never connect the loss of privacy to that bad consequence. And so we're not motivated to protect our privacy enough because we don't see the connection that clearly. So that's one thing. Another thing that I think comes into play is that people are very not very well informed about these issues. And many times it's no fault of their own. I mean, these companies have a big interest in us not being very informed about it.
Sure.
So, you know, when Facebook asks you, hey, what kind of music do you like? You think nothing of it, when in fact they're trying to infer your political tendency, your sexual orientation, and it's very sensitive. But you wouldn't think about it when you say you like curly fries or you like this kind of music or you like trivial things like that. And a third element, I think, is that people are a bit pessimistic about the ability to protect their privacy. So they say, look, my privacy is being violated every day, all the time. There's nothing I can do about it. So why should I take this effort? and deprive myself of whatever they're offering me if I don't have privacy anyway. And I think, of course, he's mistaken.
Right. But do you think it's possible to digitally protect our privacy? Because I was checking the other day an interview, I think, with the founder of Brave, the browser that promised to give you a little bit more privacy. But the point was that you have companies that, for instance, they track the way you walk. And in this way, they can uniquely identify you, even if you are using a VPN or whatever it is. So you think, gosh, this is, you know, what should I do? If I use a phone, probably it's really difficult to protect my privacy. So I wonder if you discover any better way to protect our privacy.
We can't be perfect because the data economy is so savage right now that you won't escape it entirely. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't try, for at least two reasons. First, you might minimize the kind of data that is collected on you, and that might make a big, big difference. So it might be the difference between you getting a job or not, or you being discriminated in some way or not. So for instance, it matters the kind of phone you have, because there are phones that are made by companies that make their money through personal data. And so they have a big interest in getting more personal data out of you than a company that doesn't make their money that way. It matters what kind of apps you have on your phone. There are apps that are totally unacceptable in the kind of data that they collect. And there are apps that are quite respectful. It matters what kind of laptop you have. All these little things matter. And you can minimize it a lot. And secondly, even when you fail, even when you try to protect your privacy and you fail, to try to protect your privacy makes an expressive claim that is very important. It tells companies and governments that we care about this, that we're not just saying that we care, we actually care about it. And it creates a paper trail so that when regulators see a company and they see that you tried to resist them, you said no, you didn't want that data collection. And whenever that desire is not respected, it creates evidence for regulators to later on fine companies that don't respect your privacy.
You know, Carice, every time I do a video about privacy, the immediate comments are, I don't care, I have nothing to hide. That's the classic one. And every time my answer is, I also have nothing to hide, but if I go to the toilet, I don't want to be live stream, you know, worldwide. So I'm not doing anything wrong, but I want that thing to be private. And a lot of other things, you know, a lot of conversations that I have, I want to decide what is public and what is private. But is I don't know. Sometimes I see that it's ingrained in our brain that, all right, you know, if you have nothing to hide, all right, give us the data. And I think Snowden said that government come to you and say, give us your data in exchange of your safety or security. So it's a tricky perception, maybe, that is now going mainstream, probably.
Yeah, I don't think that kind of thinking goes very deep, because for most of history and in all cultures, we have had a pretty robust sense of privacy, even though different cultures express it in different ways. And I think our parents and grandparents understood privacy much better than we do. We kind of forgot the lesson, but we're quickly relearning it, partly because I did a survey not long ago with our colleague, Sharon Brooke, and we discovered that about 92% of people have had some kind of bad experience online already related to privacy, whether it's identity theft or public humiliation, or even being the target of spyware. So as we accumulate bad experiences, we kind of learn that, okay, privacy is just as important as it used to be. And even if you have nothing to hide in the sense that you think you're doing nothing wrong, everybody has something to hide in the sense that the more data others have about you, the more power they have over you. And you don't want to be vulnerable to certain kinds of people like hackers and criminals, or like governments that are not trustworthy, or companies that are certainly not trustworthy. So the idea that you have nothing to hide is very naive.
Yeah, absolutely. And what do you think about the network effect, the power of the network effect? Because friends say, all right, now I will give up with WhatsApp. I just install Signal. Good. And then no one else has Signal in his environment. And so they say, oh, gosh, now I'm trapped. I don't have WhatsApp anymore. And I have an app, and I have to persuade everyone to install the app, and then it doesn't happen because, you know, the friction is too much. People are lazy. So how do you solve that?
We have to make the best out of these kind of moments in which people are actually like migrating in vast numbers to Signal and Telegram. So, you know, every time that somebody signs up in your contact book to Signal, you get a message. And these days I get like lots of messages. It's really nice to see. And once you've done like that minimal effort of downloading another app, given that it's free and it works just as well or better than WhatsApp, then it doesn't become hard to, you know, to sacrifice WhatsApp because it just works just as well. So whenever you have the chance, you use Signal. And on the outlier case that you don't have the chance because it's a company or because it's somebody you didn't manage to persuade, well, then you can use WhatsApp. But that minimization of use is already incredibly significant and can change things.
Don't you think, Carissa, that is a business model problem? I was chatting the other day with a friend of mine, and the difference about Netflix and Instagram. Also, Netflix collect a lot of data. By the way, I would say that every companies collect a lot of data about their clients or potential clients. But there is a big difference, I think, if you use your data for yourself to create a better relationship with your client, or you gather the data and you sell them to someone else and they profit from those data. Probably there is also this difference, or you see maybe a limit in the data use in any way. I mean, what's what are the guidelines there for you?
It's a bit of both. I think the business model that depends on selling personal data or selling access to people based on their personal data is completely toxic because it incentivizes companies to collect a lot more data than they need. And that's very dangerous to have personal data just sitting there because sooner or later it's going to be either misused or stolen or leaked or something. And it's going to be a problem for data subjects. And it also incentivizes it selling that data or that access to the highest bidder. And many times the highest bidder isn't the institution with the best interest at heart. So that's a huge problem. But it's also a problem just to collect the data for the hell of it. A lot of companies just say, look, let's collect as much data as we can, keep it, and sooner or later we'll find a way to make use of it.
Yeah.
And sometimes that means that when they go broke, they sell that data. In any case, it's like a ticking bomb. Personal data, I argue in my book, we should think about it as a toxic asset. It can be very useful for some things, like asbestos is very useful for building, but it's toxic, and sooner or later, it's going to come back and bite us. There are other kind of problematic practices, like Netflix, yes, it collects a lot of data, but then it shares it sometimes with Facebook, for instance, in exchange for seeing Facebook's data. So even though they don't sell it, they actually share it in problematic ways. And furthermore, I don't know if you have this experience, Monty, but like I used to go to a fantastic video club that was just huge. And I used to find like gems in there. And I go into Netflix and the algorithm that recommends movies is just rubbish. It's just so bad. And I just get this frustrating feeling that I spend more time looking for something that I want to watch than actually watching something that I enjoy. So I think there's also we overestimate the power of data. There's this kind of, I don't know how to call it, but like magic thinking that if you have more data, then you'll know everything and it's going to automatically transform into knowledge. And that's just not the way it works. And many times having more data actually is having more noise rather than more signal. It's just like adding hay to the haystack and making the needle all the more hard to find.
Definitely. Also, because once you have all of this data, unless you are like Google, Facebook, Amazon, whoever, but then you need the tools to analyze. I mean, it's a very tricky and lot of data really unordered, unorganized. I mean, it's not so easy to get real value from data unless you are one of these super top big tech companies. But I agree, it's crazy how sometimes you go on Netflix and they have all of this magic algorithm and you stay hours. Sometimes with my wife, you know what? We are in bed, we say, all right, let's watch something. Of course, the question number one is how long is the things, the number one variable is how long is the movie? You know, is it 2 hours too long? You know, no matter the quality. And then maybe we stay, you know, 50 minutes just to try to find something. And then we give up. We say, all right, nothing. We couldn't find anything. And or the algorithm say, this is a 95% Monty. And I say, man, this is horrible. I would never watch this stuff. So anyway, it's, data is crazy. And the problem is, of course, as you say, companies on one side, but governments on the other side. The more data a government has, the worse could go. I mean, you are potentially always they can hold you responsible for something. If they know everything about you, you do something wrong, probably. I mean, sooner or later, and it's very easy to I don't know how you say in English, to keep you under control. Yeah.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And on the one hand, that is a real threat to democracy because you can always go in fishing expeditions. There are so many laws, for instance, in the United States, you have so many thousands of laws that are very obscure that if you want to get rid of someone because they're uncomfortable to the government, you just have to dig enough and you'll find something or other. For instance, maybe they wore a mask in public or something. And we learned in the Occupy Wall Street protest how there was a law against it, even though it hadn't been applied for dozens of years. So on the one hand, that's a risk. But one thing that makes me optimistic is that governments are also learning that having that personal data is very dangerous to national security. So here are a few examples. One is that the internet is built in a very insecure way to allow for data collection. But that also means that hackers can get into it very easily. So from North Korea or Russia or wherever, were to hack just 10% of appliances in a country and turn them on at the same time, they could bring down the national grid. And if you imagine like that happening during the pandemic, which there have been attempts of attack to the national grid in the UK, for instance, if we're in lockdown, just imagine what that would be like. It would be like really catastrophic. So that's one risk. But there are other risks. So for instance, the New York Times had a piece about a year ago in which two journalists who were not very tech savvy wanted to find out where the president of the United States was through location data. So they got this location data from a data broker, which is perfectly legal, and gets sold all the time to the highest bidder. And without much effort, they found the phone of a secret agent and they could tell the location of the president of the United States. And if they can tell that, nobody's safe and no country is safe. So I think this will be a really important motivator for governments to regulate personal data much better.
In our chat, Federico is asking how to deal with data brokers that you just mentioned and the market of data. What about eliminating that liar? Well, tomorrow we wake up and say, that's it. There is no data brokering anymore.
That's exactly what I argue. It's the first book to call for an end of the data economy in the sense that personal data shouldn't be the kind of thing that you sell and buy. Even in the most capitalist societies, we agree that there are certain things that just shouldn't be for sale, like votes, because it undermines the spirit of democracy. And in the same way, personal data does exactly the same thing, in particular when personal data is being used for political campaigns. And so I argue that data brokers shouldn't exist and that anyone who wants to manage or collect data has a duty of care. So they have something like a fiduciary duty, just like lawyers have towards their clients or doctors have towards their patients, such that they should only be able to use information about you to benefit you and never against you.
The thing that all the tech companies say, Google, for instance, they always say, Sundar Pichai, I heard in front of the Congress, he said, guys, we collect data in the interest of our clients, of our customers, because in this way we can give you a better search result, personalized result. I think the word personalized is the one that trigger everyone say, yeah, if it's personalized, thank you so much, Sundar. Or Facebook is a personalized feed, and this is exception number one. And exception number two that everyone say is always, but we give you all the tools to decide how much of your data you want to share. We don't, we give you all the control panel and the tools that, so you are in charge. So they push back to us users the responsibility that if privacy is not there, is our fault because we had the tools. You know, it's like the PlayStation that say you had parental control. So if your kid is spending $3 million on your credit card, it's your fault. It's not our fault. And you say, why? Why should it be like that? Anyway, what do you think about these two exceptions?
I think you mentioned a lot of interesting things there. One is the like this thing about language, calling it personalized. It just like personalized used to mean VIP, right? And now it doesn't mean that at all. It just means like we're talking to our own particular mind to mess with it in the best possible way. So that's one thing. But another thing is that it's not true that they give us control. I mean, it's kind of an illusion because on the one hand, there are many things that you can't opt out of. Just like WhatsApp is just take it or leave it. That's the main way for big tech companies to manage data. On the other hand, many of these settings are very obscure. So there was a news a few years ago about how Google offered you to tick off the collection of personal data about location. And it seemed like if you just put off location history, then you were safe. But actually, you weren't. So in order for Google to stop collecting data about your location, you had to go into a very obscure setting that was called activity or something like that, that had nothing, that didn't have the word privacy on it or personal data or location, and turn it off. So it was very misleading. Furthermore, there's an argument for why we shouldn't have that responsibility. We don't have the responsibility of entering a restaurant and making sure that the food is edible and that it's not, you know, I don't know, turtle meat or anything that's forbidden or drugs or and in the same way, we shouldn't have that kind of responsibility. It's too much of a burden. We don't have time to read these privacy policies, and they're not written for us. They're written to protect the big tech companies. So we need a system in which the default is no personal data collection or very minimal personal data collection, and we should make an effort to have our personal data collected. And even at that, we shouldn't be allowed to share just any kind of personal data. One of the things I argue in the book is that it's a mistake to think about privacy as an individual thing, because every time I share my personal data, I share data about others. So for instance, if you share data about your location, you're sharing data about your spouse, about your neighbors. If you share your genetic data, obviously you're sharing data about your siblings, your parents, your kids, but also a very distant kin that can have really bad consequences. Already there have been a case of deportation in Canada from genetic tests, and you might never know that your genetic test worked for something like this. So really, privacy is a collective affair.
I like it. I like the concept. In chat, there is Stefano saying something about the cookies, accepting all the cookies. He's really cross. How annoying, he says, are accepting cookies all the freaking time. Website don't really give other choices. I'll be verified by now. I don't know why he said I'll be verified. But apart from that, no, I think this is an interesting point. The idea of privacy then is, all right, click on this button and say yes or no. And now every time you visit a website, you have this very annoying pop-up that no one reads, no one ever in the history of humankind. And if you write accept or not, often is always the same, you know, like, yeah, all right, click it, and now we do whatever we want. So it's you have the feeling that there is more privacy, but in the reality, there is not. I mean, it's still the same situation. You just do a click more. And again, like Google or the other guys, they say, all right, are you sure? We are telling you this. Do you accept? And you can't do anything different anyway if you want to use the service. But again, the exception is free. So why you complain, Monty, is free. So it's your decision to use it. But on the other side, in my opinion, is that it's a de facto service. Everyone use it. And if you're out from there, it's like saying, I'm out, I'm not using the highway. I just go from, I don't know, one city to another, not using the highway. Of course I can do it. But the truth is that it's very, very complicated and you are out of a social circle and you, the peer pressure that is there. So there are a lot of mechanism and it's complicated. Help, Carissa.
Well, yeah, it shows how the consent for data. I mean, among other things, there's no possible meaning of like consent when you don't know where your data is going to end up or how it's going to be used. And you can't know, because even data scientists don't know. They don't know who the company is going to sell the data to and what kind of inference we might get from it 10 years down the line. So meaningful consent is totally impossible when it comes to data. That's one thing. Another thing is that I don't have the moral authority to share my data when it impacts you, right? So for instance, with Cambridge Analytica, only 270,000 people agreed to have their data collected by Cambridge Analytica. But what moral authority did they have to give access to 87 million of their friends and then for that data to be used for a tool that will try to sway our elections and will try to thwart our democracy? So that's another thing. And also, it just practically, like the comment said, it just doesn't make any sense, because if you click no to every cookie, like I try to do, then next time they won't be able to remember you. So you'll have to click again. And it's so burdensome. It's just totally irrational. Whereas if the default was no data collection and you had to make an effort to have your data collected, then they could remember you, right? And so you wouldn't have to make that choice every time.
Right. On the other side, Carissa, as an entrepreneur doing digital startups, I would say that today the entire digital marketing ecosystem, even if you are super ethical and you respect your users, your clients, everything, if you want to do everything right, still the default is that, I mean, you collect so many data. I just Google Analytics. I mean, I just first tool that come up in my mind, or Hotjar that measure track the way you move your mouse on a website, on a landing page. I mean, there are so many tools, and today is an entire industry. Is all internet marketing based on collecting data, even in a good way, with a good purpose, but still is there. So I wonder, how can you change an entire industry? Or in the case of Facebook, Mark should come tomorrow in front of the Congress and say, all right, I changed the business model. Now you pay for Facebook as a subscription model. We don't collect data anymore. And that's it. I think it's very difficult that this will happen, unless they are forced to, probably. What do you think?
It's not easy, and it's probably the case that they will need to be forced. I mean, my sense is that Zuckerberg is never going to question his business model. He's just going to go on to the death, even though, you know, Apple is pressuring to change the business model. There is a fight between them, even though regulators are fighting them, even though people are complaining, they're just going on to the very end. But I think that we shouldn't be so pessimistic. We've done this before. So, for instance, in the case of the ozone layer, we were destroying the ozone layer by using CFCs, and CFCs were incredibly common. We were using them all over the place. We realized this was incredibly dangerous. We changed the practice, and industry came up with alternatives. We've gotten rid of all kinds of practices, child labor, practices from the Industrial Revolution. If you told someone from the 1900s that we would have holidays and 8-hour shifts and weekends and maternity leave and all these kinds of things, it would seem absolutely impossible. So we shouldn't be so pessimistic. And we've managed to regulate every other industry, from railroads to cars to trains, food, drugs. There's no reason why we shouldn't be able to regulate this.
Patrizia is asking, how do we know how far our data travels? Like, for instance, if my data from Italy is collected by a website from the other side of the world, what regulations apply? Have you done any research on how these data are collected? Where do they go? Who owns all of this data? Like, also this data broker? Because my feeling is that my personal data are in so many places around the world. I have no idea where, but definitely they are, probably with backups and cloud. Where are those data?
That's absolutely true. And it's not very easy to track, because much of this data is held by private companies that are not transparent about where they hold it and exactly in what manner. And a lot of it also is intercepted by governments. So, for instance, much of the internet goes through the United States. So if your data goes through a cable that goes through the United States and an agency like the NSA intercepts that cable, everything will be there and there will be a copy of it somewhere in the United States. But where? Who knows? And it just goes incredibly far. Not only through interception and companies collecting their own data, but also through data brokers. So you have to assume that data brokers have a file on you and that file gets bought by insurance companies, by banks, by a prospective employer, if it's a big employer, by governments, and who knows what can be in that file. Sometimes even there's inaccurate data, and you might be judged unfairly on the basis of inaccurate data and never know about it.
Right. But if I turn off my digital life, which in my case would be would mean go bankrupt because everything is digital in my life, every company, everything. But let's say that I say, that's it. No more digital, no internet connection, nothing. Then I go out here in Brighton and I'll be recorded by 300 million CCTV and there are people doing selfies and I'm in because they are doing, you know. So I'm inside this world that keep recording. And I was also reading about the driverless cars, for instance, they will record so much data to just work, to properly function. So you should completely change the way we record data, store data, share data. I mean, not only online, I mean, everywhere. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I agree with that because it's just too dangerous to have it. I mean, a best case scenario is something like we have a huge data leak. Like, for instance, imagine all the fingerprints and biometric details that airports collect many times through private companies. Sooner or later, we'll have a leak of that data. And it's going to be a mess because you can change your password, but you can't change your face or your fingerprints. So that's like a best case scenario in which, okay, that is enough to wake us up and keep, you know, get better at keeping data safe. At the moment, we have gotten really good at collecting data and we're still really bad at keeping that data safe. A worst case scenario is something like genocide happening somewhere in the West for people to really wake up and say, okay, we have to never do this again. And this has already happened in a way. During the Second World War, the Nazis really made use of personal data to find the Jewish population. The first thing they did when they invaded a city was to go to the registry. And there's a study that compares the country that had most personal data on their citizens, which was the Netherlands, versus the country that had the least personal data, which was France. And France had made a very conscious decision not to collect data about religious affiliation for privacy reasons. And the result is that the Nazis found 75% of the Jewish population in the Netherlands and killed them. And in France, they found 25%. And the difference is in the hundreds of thousands of people. There's a particular story of the Amsterdam Registry that I think is very illustrative of the problem. There was a resistance cell that tried to realize what was happening and decided to try to destroy the records. So they went into the registry, they set fire to the files, and they had a deal with the fire department that the firemen would arrive late so that the fire could destroy more, and they would use more water than necessary, again, to destroy more files, as many files as possible. And unfortunately, they were very unsuccessful. They only managed to destroy about 15% of records, and the Nazis found 70,000 Jews in Amsterdam. And the lesson is twofold. On the one hand, the Dutch were collecting much more personal data than was needed, and that was wise. And the second mistake was that they didn't have an easy way to delete the data in the event of an emergency. And we're making both those mistakes at a grand scale.
Another exception that governments do when we talk about data is that in case of terrorism attack for national security, we'll need all of this data. And everyone, when something bad happens, say, yeah, go find them, go get them, use everything you can, like in the movies, all of the, you know, softwares and so that you can find the bodies, basically. What do you think about this? Because this always happens, and every time that happens something really bad, like 9/11, boom, more data are collected, more power to governments to collect data usually.
Yeah, I think this is a very intuitive thought and probably well-intentioned at the beginning. But now we have enough evidence to think that this is just not the case. First, big data is not the kind of thing that can prevent terrorist attacks. No matter how much data we could have had, we would have never been able to prevent somebody using a pot for an attack in the Boston Marathon or somebody using a truck to run into people. That's just not, big data is very good at figuring out patterns within troves of data. And I mean troves. So like it's very good at figuring out what you want to buy tomorrow because there are billions of people buying things every day. But terrorism is a very isolated event. And terrorists are trying to hide. So it's not the same kind of data. And big data just doesn't work for that. That's one thing. But another thing is also that we have to balance off the risk of a terrorist attack versus the risk of a genocide or personal data being used for a terrorist attack and being we're creating our own risk in that sense. Furthermore, even if we had everything encrypted, we didn't have the data economy anymore, we didn't sell or buy personal data, intelligence agencies and police would still have more data than ever before just because of metadata. So metadata is data about data, it's the data that computers create just while we're using them. And that is incredibly sensitive. It tells you, like, with whom people are messaging and where they are and other kinds of information that give police plenty of information to find the bad guys in the case of a terrorist attack.
Got it. And what about the data that are collected and shared for, let's say, good reasons? Because obviously, Carissa, I'm trying to think about all the exceptions that governments and companies use to say, yes, let's collect more data, much more data as possible. Another exception is, for instance, with the COVID, the fact that they can collect so much data about what's going on and share those data among the scientific community is a way to find a solution much faster, basically. And with this idea, the main problem that can arise is, all right, but then where is the limit? I mean, what kind of data are you collecting about me? Everything? Like, there is no limit, or there is a limit. So what do you think about this?
First, we have to come up with a data landscape that we can trust. Because when people don't trust, and right now people don't trust, and for very good reasons, first, they don't volunteer data, and then they can obfuscate data. So for instance, now we have the situation in which COVID data has been misused. In Singapore, for instance, the government had said that they wouldn't use that data for police purposes, and now the police gets access. In the UK, the data that was used by companies to see who was in a restaurant, to check into restaurants, got sold on. So these kind of betrayals mean that people don't want to download the app, right? Because they don't trust the government and they don't trust the companies because they've been betrayed time and time and again. So that shows that if we want to use data for good, we have to make sure that people can trust us. And right now, companies and governments have not earned our trust. So that's one thing. And another thing also related to your past question is that we shouldn't think of like black and white cases. It's not like because data brokers are really toxic and right now we have a really toxic environment, then we can't collect personal data at all and this is the end of it. It's not that. The devil is in the details. So sure, we have to collect personal data, for instance, for the purposes of medicine. But that, for that to work really well, it means that we have to keep it safe. We have to delete it when we don't need it anymore. And we have to make sure that people know that when they go to the doctor, that information stays with the doctor and it won't be sold on to Google that will later misuse it and it won't be hacked and leaked and turned into a security issue. Otherwise, we're never going to really advance and make the best of personal data.
I agree. One thing, and to close this conversation, Carissa, that was very, very interesting for me, is I was really shocked by the fact that when Snowden proved that the NSA was spying and collecting all kind of data about everyone basically in the world, he proved that, right? So it was not an idea, a conspiracy theory. No, it was a fact. And despite of that, nothing changed. Yeah, all right, he's a buddy, let's go get him. But no one stopped one second to say, all right, but now we stop that, we change completely. That's not the discussion. Immediately, they pivot, the U.S. government pivot the focus on the fact that he was like, I don't know, a Russian spy or whatever. So I don't know, I was shocked because I thought, wow, in front of such an important fact, humanity will do something. No, nothing. So I don't know. I wonder, what do we need to happen to really change things and say, all right, that's it, this is over?
That's a good question. I think that, first of all, we have such a big machinery that it's hard to change things. They have their own momentum, and we're not very good at stopping things like really abruptly. And that's partly because we have a democracy, and in a democracy, everything has to go through a lot, so many phases and so many people that it often gets watered down. But it's not true that nothing changed. So it started a conversation that we wouldn't have been able to have, and that has changed a lot of things. It has changed in legislation, and it has changed in... So I wrote my dissertation on privacy because of Snowden, probably. I mean, or at least in some part because of Snowden. And so we still haven't seen the end of it. It's in fact kind of the beginning, because people are now becoming aware, and it takes a lot of years for people to become aware of something that's so abstract. So I'm not entirely pessimistic. What I fear is that we might need to wait for something really bad to happen with personal data for people to really change, and for us to really take seriously how dangerous and how toxic personal data is. So I hope we don't get there, but we might need a real scare, or we might need some. So, you know, after the Second World War was when the Charter for Human Rights came up, and we made so many changes to stop that from happening. And it's a shame that that had to happen for those positive changes to take place. So I hope we don't run into the same kind of situation. And I hope we can change rules before, now that we see the danger. And, you know, people might say, well, it's insane to just say that we should end the data economy. But really what's insane is to have a business model that depends on the systematic violation of rights. That's just unacceptable.
Yeah. What's your daily privacy routine? Do you have any recipe to share with us?
So I make mistakes like everyone else, and also I'm trying to get the message out, and that makes me exposed in a way that I wish I wasn't. And that, you know, if you're an accountant or a barber or a lawyer, you don't need necessarily to be. But I have Signal. I close my camera. Like, I have a little thing for the camera and the microphone. I choose really privacy-friendly options, so I use DuckDuckGo instead of Google. I try to choose the better laptop and phone and the safer ones. I keep my phone away from me sometimes, so like if I want to have an intimate moment with somebody or if I want to have an important conversation, I keep the phone out. I try my best, and I think it makes a big difference, even though it's far from perfect, among other reasons. Because companies listen. Like, WhatsApp is really annoyed right now that people are leaving its platform. And that matters.
Yeah, absolutely. The other day, I got one of my children, 11 years old. We were talking, and then he saw an ad on the phone, and he said, but Instagram was listening to me. And I say, well, you know, this is a long discussion that is running. Is the microphone active? Like, Alexa is listening. Yeah, of course it's listening. And then the company say, no, but it's not really listening. And it's only local listening, but only if it's active. You know, there are a lot of distinctions. But of course, I mean, there is a microphone in a phone, and someone has access and can listen or record. So that's scary sometimes, you know, when you see, or also when you see, I don't remember the Google feature where you can listen back to what you asked to Google, and you hear your voice 2 years ago asking something. I say, gosh, that's me, you know. It's a really scary scenario.
never done that. That sounds bad. And the other day I was talking with someone, I forget who, about 1984. And in some ways, this is much worse than Big Brother, because like Orwell didn't think that we might be voluntarily carrying spies on ourselves in our pockets every day. Like Winston didn't have that.
Yeah, it's crazy. But I'm really happy about your new book. First book. Is your first book?
Yeah, it's my first book.
First book, great. Privacy is power. Good luck with that. Really, really, a very important topic in this moment. And let's keep in touch. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Monty.
Bye.
Bye.